You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight we talk about the great vocalist Ella Fitzgerald with my guest, Jeffrey Mark. Jeffrey Mark is a performer and a radio personality, and he's written about Lucille Ball and Ethel Merman and Ella Fitzgerald. He's just published Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. Jeffrey Mark, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's my great pleasure to be with you, Gary.
It's a very beautiful book, Ella, and it's to commemorate the 100th birthday of Ella Fitzgerald?
Yes, this is her centennial year. Hard to imagine. Those of us who are old enough to remember her as, well, I'm not quite that old, a young woman, but many of us remember her being a middle-aged woman. The idea of her, it's 100 years now, it's like, wow, do I feel old. But I think it's an honor for her that so many years later, we're still talking about her, we're still reading about her, and we're still listening to her gorgeous music.
Did you ever have a chance to meet her in your life?
Yes, I was very lucky. In Ella's later years, I got to meet her and help her a little bit. A hallmark of Ella's work, and I know there's so many topics we can talk about Ella Fitzgerald, but for those of you, our friends who are listening who don't know, Ella is the most recorded female in history outside of opera, which means that she had at any given moment 400 or 500 arrangements that she could choose from in which to do a concert. And Mr. Sinatra, Miss Streisand, Mr. Bennett, when they went out on tour, they chose 12, 15, 18 songs, and that was their act for the next 3 months. Ella never did that. Ella sang what she felt like that night. So at any given point, it could be almost anything she chose from, which is very, very rare for a performer. But towards the end, she began singing some of the same songs over and over and over again. Her longtime pianists had left her. She wasn't working quite as often, and she was forgetting. So I made up playlists for her in order, like this is your opening song, this is your second song, this is your ballad. And I made up enough of them, choosing songs that would fit her voice, because her voice did change as she aged, that she could sing comfortably and still bring a new sensation to her fans, because it was tremendously important to her that she never bore her people, that anyone who paid a dollar to see Ella Fitzgerald got their dollar's worth. Maybe that's why we loved her so much, because she loved us so much.
Well, how did it happen that you met her and were able to help her in this way?
My mother-in-law had dated, and we'll put the word dated in quotation marks, when she was a teenager, a man by the name of Val Valentin, who grew up to be the man who worked the dials on all of Ella Fitzgerald's recordings through the years. He was her sound engineer. And we took my mother-in-law to see Ella at the Hollywood Bowl. And I mentioned Val, and she told us the story of how they knew each other. And she barged her way in backstage and found that Val was indeed her sound engineer at the live concert. She introduced us. He knew who I was, invited me to lunch. And he said, you know, young man, you're such a good writer. You should do a book before we all die, and there's no one left to ask any questions of. And that was the beginning of the book. That was more than 25 years ago.
This book, and it's called Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald, is this based on the previous book that you had written, The First Lady of Song?
The information about her career is mostly the same. But we added, there isn't a page in the book I didn't rewrite completely. When the book, the original book, my first book on Ella, was published, Ella was still alive. Norman Granz, her longtime manager, was still alive. Her ex-husband was still alive. Her musicians were still alive. Her arrangers were still alive. I had to be careful what I wrote. So there was a tremendous amount of information about her personal life I just couldn't use. And then, of course, what about her death? What about her last illness? They hadn't happened yet. So I was able to go back with respect and love. There's nothing in the book that's sensationalized or dramatized, or there's nothing in there the National Enquirer is going to have headlines about. But I do tell the true story of her childhood, how she lived as a teenager, what she had to do to become Ella Fitzgerald, how she maintained herself, how she lived as a woman, what were her relationships with her family like, what were her professional relationships like, and then what happened? How did illness affect her? What were her last years like? What was her last few days like? And then the incredible story about her last day on Earth. So all of that is there, plus every song, every album, every movie, every radio show, every TV show. It's 450 pages long with over 270 photographs. And if you order now through the deluxe version, I did a show in April at the Grammy Museum with wonderful Patty Austin for Ella's 100th birthday. And I happened to run into the public relations people for Universal Music. As it turns out, Universal Music either owns or distributes all of Ella's music, except for just a couple of years in the late 60s. And I said, gee, wouldn't it be great to have that music in the book, that you can read all about it, and now you can listen to it at the same time. So after much negotiation, the deluxe version of the book has two CDs in it. One is all studio, one is all live, from 1935 to 1990, so 7 decades of music. I've chosen what I thought were the best, and I've put them in the order I just know Ella would have if she was choosing them and putting them in order herself. This is the way she would have done it. So the book has just so much more. It's like the first book was good, but this is in another universe all by itself. Is that egotistical enough?
Well, I can attest to the fact that it's a beautiful book, a very well-written book with beautiful, beautiful photos that I've never seen before.
Well, you know, my publisher at Ultimate Symbol, Mies Hora, is a wonderful graphic designer besides being a publisher, and he took what was there and just made it look gorgeous. So the book looks gorgeous. It's the print is large enough for those of us who are over 40 to read it. It is topical enough for those of us who are under 40 to understand what she brought to the table, why she was so great, all the people she influenced, and there would not have been a Diana Ross, a Michael Jackson, a Beyoncé without Ella Fitzgerald first. And I really shouldn't limit myself to just African-American performers. There's a whole lot of folks that wouldn't have been without Ella Fitzgerald first. Even go all the way back to the Andrews Sisters. And for those of you who don't know, they were a three-sister harmony group who were huge in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I had dinner with Patty Andrews, and I said, you know, how Ella kind of copied you when she was young. She said, honey, you've got it backwards. Me, Doris Day, Dinah Shore, and then she rattled off 5 or 6 other names our friends out there may not be familiar with. She said, we all copied Ella. She was the original. We wanted to sound like her. And then I talked to Maxine Andrews, her sister, who did the lower voices and the harmonies. And she said, because Patty sounded that way, we had to sing that way. So the Andrews sisters' whole sound was based on Ella Fitzgerald. That's how influential she was to other singers. That's how important she is to the history of music.
Well, now, I don't think she's the first female African-American singer to get mainstream success. I think maybe you might say Ethel Waters would predate her in that area, but she's the first to have a kind of a sound that was, well, how would you describe the sound?
Unique, because nobody can do an imitation of her. Ethel Waters, a wonderfully gifted African-American actress and singer, was more famous really on Broadway, more famous in the couple of films that she made. Her recordings were more popular with the African-American people. She wasn't as mainstream as Ella became. Billie Holiday wasn't even as mainstream as Ella became. I think Ella really was the first woman of color where her audience wasn't all white or all black or all anything. She appealed across the board, which was extraordinarily rare back then. Certainly Bessie Smith, Louis Armstrong, Billy is a couple of years ahead of Ella age-wise, but Ella really kicked the door in for everybody else. For any kind of a singer to be mainstream, it didn't matter what your background was. Ella kind of kicked the door in.
Well, I love Billie Holiday. I think she's one of the greatest, but there's a certain accessibility to Ella that Billie Holiday doesn't have.
Miss Holiday was not as happy a woman as Ella was. You can't, it's the purple elephant in the room. You can't undo the drug addiction. And I'm saying this as someone who's in recovery many, 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 many years myself. When you're a singer and you're drinking or drugging, it impacts your body. Your body is your instrument, and if your body becomes damaged, your instrument becomes damaged. But Billy was never a scat singer. She was never really an up-tempo singer. Her thing was torch songs and songs of sorrow and songs of heartbreak, and even her up-tempo things sounded sad. She was brilliant. There was nobody like her. But she wasn't as adaptable, you know. Billy went from record label to record label to record label, singing the same 20 songs over and over again. Ella could sing anything. So, yes, I love Billy, and I love hearing her voice. But Ella could do more with her voice, is my opinion. I wrote the book, so of course I'm prejudiced.
Love and kisses, ever misses, making heaven fall. Coming from someone like you, your perfection, true affection, creates a perfect design. Love has found us, joy has found us, planning a future divine. So in decision, I know that my vision is clear. When you are near, no need for sunlight, for you are the one light I see, so real to me. Love and kisses, that's what bliss is, blessing whatever you do. Full completeness, rich with sweetness, coming from someone like you.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Jeffrey Mark. He's the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald called Ella. We'll be back with more of our conversation right after this. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. Tonight we're talking with Jeffrey Mark about Ella Fitzgerald. But before we continue, let's listen to Ella when she was a vocalist for Chick Webb, singing her classic, A Tisket, A Tasket.
A tisket, a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mummy. On the way I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it, a little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was trucking on down the avenue, but not a single thing to do. She went peck, peck, pecking all around. When she spied it on the ground, she took it, she took it, my little yellow basket. And if she doesn't bring it back, I think that I will die. A tisket, a tasket, I lost my yellow basket. And if that girlie don't return it, don't know what I'll do. Oh dear, I wonder where my basket can be. Oh gee, I wish that little girl I could see. Oh, why was I so careless with that basket of mine? That itty bitty basket was the joy of mine. A tisket, a tisket, basket. I lost my yellow basket. Won't someone help me find my basket and make me happy again, again?
Was it green?
No, 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 no.
Was it red?
No, 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 no.
Was it blue?
No, 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 no. Just a little yellow basket. A little yellow basket.
Ella Fitzgerald with Chick Webb's orchestra singing A Tisket, A Tasket. Jeffrey Mark is my guest, and he's the author of a beautiful new biography of Ella Fitzgerald called Ella. Jeffrey Mark, you can really hear the girlish quality in her voice that Ella was famous for early in her career.
Well, there was a reason for that. She was a girl. You know, she started singing with Chick Webb right around age 16. And part of the appeal of her was that she was so young. So even as she grew older, it was part of her stage character to play the young girl. And it really wasn't until after World War II, after Chick Webb had passed away, and World War II had drafted all the sidemen from her orchestra, because Ella became the first African-American woman to lead her own orchestra. When Chick died, she took over the orchestra. But they all got drafted. By that point, her repertoire was changing. And then once she began doing the bebop music, Lady Be Good and How High the Moon and Airmail Special, she was no longer pretending to be 15 years old anymore. It was a little bit of a put-on. But the other amazing thing about listening to Ella, almost more than any other singer, is how her voice changes through the years. There's a constant growth. She didn't freeze herself at age 30, and this is the way I sing the rest of my life. She was continuously experimenting, continuously growing. The thing with having so many different songs, she recorded over 2,400 songs in her life, not singing the same things over and over and over again. There was no, we're going to see Ella tonight and she'll sing her greatest hits. No. If she felt like it, maybe you got one, but she sang what she felt that night. And if you listen to her music in the 70s, it's much different from her music in the 50s. Not better, not worse, but different and interesting. She never bored. There was nothing boring about what Ella did. It was always fascinating, interesting, entertaining, and she gave whatever her best was on that given day. A real pro.
Did racism affect her success?
Tremendously. You can't, as celebrated as she was, the honorary doctorates, the Kennedy Center, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, honors in Italy, honors in France, honors in Great Britain, honors in Japan. She comes up in the 1930s, and if she came up today, racism would still play a part in her life. That's just, unfortunately and wrongly, how things are. But especially in her day, her mother and father were never married. Her mother and her stepfather were never married. Her stepfather was Portuguese. He wasn't black. A mixed family in a mixed neighborhood. She knew from day one what racism was, and she knew what misogyny was. And she knew that as a woman, she was considered less than. And she spent her entire life fighting those. And she won. She won. But boy, did she have to fight to get there. And she had good friends help her, a wonderful manager in Norman Granz, who brooked no nonsense. If she could sing in your hotel, she had to stay in your hotel. You won't let her? She's not singing. But also Marilyn Monroe did a lot for her. She and Marilyn were very good girlfriends. I mean that in the, like, two girls having coffee together kind of girlfriend thing. And Marilyn stood up for Ella. Marilyn is the one who went and said, you won't book her? You book her, and 10 nights in a row, I'll bring in 10 huge movie stars, and we'll spend hundreds of dollars in your establishment if you book Ella. And they did, and she did, and Ella never had to get worried about booking again. Marilyn came with Ella in Denver to a place to play, because Marilyn went wherever Ella was if she could. And when it came time to go back, they wanted Ella to go in the back door. And Marilyn hooked her arm into Ella's and in front of the press said, Ella Fitzgerald and Marilyn Monroe enter the front door, or Ella Fitzgerald and Marilyn Monroe don't enter at all. That never happened again. And Ella learned a wonderful lesson that women do have power, that you don't have to sit back and be a lady. You can advocate for yourself. And this is a very shy woman. If you think Marilyn was a delicate flower, Ella was terribly personally shy and private, never wanted to talk about her personal life with even her closest friends. So for her to stand up like that was very difficult, but she did it. She was there for Dr. Martin Luther King in the 60s, both financially and personally. And when I say she kicked doors down, this is what I mean. There were people, and I'll mention one, Sammy Davis Jr., who wrote two autobiographies claiming he did everything. He did a lot, but before he did it, Ella did it. Ella did it so he could do it, so the next person could do it. It's just that Ella never took any bows for it. It's like saying, I can breathe. Well, of course you can breathe. Everyone can breathe. Well, Ella was saying, well, I did this because I can. I should. Why should I take a bow for this? Ella's outlook, maybe, was, I was born with these talents. They're a gift. I should not be taking bows for having a gift. What I do with the gift, that I take pardonable, not pride, but I will take a bow for what I've done with what I was given. But she was never egotistical. She felt grateful, lucky, and had an incredible, incredible work ethic. We're talking about a woman who toured Europe, Japan, South America, the Caribbean, all over North America, Australia, and New Zealand, 42 weeks a year, two shows a night, 6 days a week, year in and year out, and radio and television shows and movies and television specials all around the globe that we've never seen here in the United States. And I keep saying and because it's almost unbelievable. Between just 1956 and 1960, she recorded in the studio and live enough material to fill 27 CDs in 4 years. Today it takes them 4 years to record one song. It's amazing that she didn't wear herself out sooner than she did.
Her recordings, at first when she was recording on Decca, her songs are... Her records are all 3 minutes or 3.5 minutes, as most records were. But then when she came to Verve and started doing those great songbook albums, it wasn't unusual for her to have a 6-minute recording.
Yes, yes. And for that, we have Norman Granz to thank. Now, I've worked for Verve and I've worked for Decca. Now they're all one company, so I've worked for everybody. Back then, Decca Records, who was one of the major record labels at the time, big people were on Decca Records. They never forgot a tisket a tasket. They were always looking for another novelty song for Ella. They didn't pair her up with Bing Crosby on record. They only put her with other black people. They didn't allow for integrated recording sessions. And the songs she was given were sometimes lackluster, sometimes good, and some of them are wonderful. But they were not the great songs of the day. Norman Granz became her manager and wanted to record her. Decca wouldn't let her go. So Decca, by this point, was owned by MCA, which also owned Universal Studios. And they wanted to make an album of the film of the Benny Goodman story. And Benny was still alive, and all of his men were still alive. But they were all under personal contract to Norman Granz. So Norman said to Decca, you want a cast album? You want a movie? You want them in your movie? Give me Ella, you can have your movie and your album. And Decca let go of Ella to make a lousy movie and a lousy album. And Steve Allen was a dear friend of mine and my mentor, and he starred in the movie, and he said it was a lousy movie. But it got Ella free. And that's when Norman was able to produce her in the studio and really bring in the best songs of the best contemporary 20th century songwriters, done by the best arrangers, and really let Ella blossom and a legend. There's so much talk today of the Great American Songbook. That comes out of Ella Fitzgerald. You mentioned just now this series of songbooks of Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and Duke Ellington and Harold Arlen and George and Ira Gershwin. She set the pace for everybody else. We're still talking about this stuff because of Ella Fitzgerald. So Norman's contribution to her legend is huge and cannot be underestimated. Does that mean he was always right? Does that mean that they didn't fight? No, they fought constantly. But he usually won, which led to one of the most legendary moments in her career. There's always a story in a story, and really all you have to know to understand the genius of this is that there had been a musical in Berlin during Nazi times about a slasher, and in this musical was a song. The folks who wrote it and the librettist of it were Jewish, left Nazi Germany, came to America, and they put the song on Broadway, the show on Broadway. Same song, English lyrics, this very slow, lugubrious song about a slasher. 2 decades go by, and for some reason, Bobby Darin records it as this up-tempo, swinging song, and he's a number one hit with it. Louis Armstrong hears it, wants to record it. He records a cover version. He has a number one hit with it. Now we're in February of 1960, and we are in Berlin. And Ella is about to start a European tour, and Norman Granz comes backstage and says, Ella, I want you to sing Mack the Knife. And Ella, doing what she always was told, turned to him and said, no, I don't like the song. I don't understand the song. I don't know the words. Why would I do this? He said, because it's a Berlin song. They're German. They don't speak English. They won't know what you're saying, but they'll know the tune, and it'll give you a hit with them here locally. And Paul Smith was her pianist. He was there, and he said, I'll tell you what, Ella. I'll just do this little vamp behind you. Sing as much of it as you want. When you're done, you're done. We'll go on to the next song. She went out there in front of 10,000 people and got through the first, oh, 2.5, 3 choruses of the song. And not only didn't know what the words were, I don't think she knew what country she was in. And rather than giggle her way through it or end the song or bebop her way through it, on her feet, she made up a whole new song to the same tune. All of the words fit the meter of the song. All of the words rhymed exactly where they should had someone spent weeks or months writing this song. And Norman Granz was wrong. The audience did speak English. And they went wild at what she did. They knew exactly what happened. On her feet, she wrote them a song, a word at a time. They gave her so much love and so much energy that she followed it with a 7.5-minute version of Mack the Knife that she sung as if she was on crystal meth. But she wasn't. It was just the energy of the crowd loving her. Those two songs, Mack the Knife, How High the Moon, taken back to back, are the finest example of vocal jazz singing that's ever been done, probably ever will done. Grammy Award for Best Song, Grammy Award for Best Album, and Mack the Knife became Ella's second theme song after Itiskitatasket. And I defy anyone who loves any kind of music to listen to the album Ella in Berlin and hear these two things and just not get goosebumps about what's going on. It's just, that is the making of a legend.
Sunday morning, eyes and body, oozing life. Someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me, could it be, Mack the Knife? Oh, what's the next chorus to this song now?
That was Ella Fitzgerald singing Mack the Knife from her Ella in Berlin album. She was really making it up as she went along, Jeffrey Mark?
Yeah. I'm not kidding. I'm not exaggerating. I am not gilding a lily to make a good story. This is exactly what happened. And you can hear it in the music. You can hear it as you're listening to it. None of this was prepared. This is someone who is so comfortable in front of audiences, who trusted her musicians so much, who trusted her own talent so much, and had the confidence to be in the moment musically and just do it. What makes a musical genius? We could spend 4 hours on a show defining what that means, but here is an example of it, a tangible example. This is a moment of musical genius.
Well, the woman was Ella, and the book is called Ella, A Biography of the Legendary Ella Fitzgerald, and it's written by my guest, Jeffrey Mark. Jeffrey Mark, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, sir. And let's tell folks they can get it at Amazon.com and at UltimateSymbol.com.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to chat with Monica Lewis, a big band singer. She passed away at the age of 93 in 2015. America's singing sweetheart. She sang with Benny Goodman and other big bands, and she was the singing voice of Chiquita Banana.
You opened for Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis at the Copacabana in 1948, and there's this tantalizing poster in the book that says you did 3 shows a night, including a 2 a.m. show. Take us back to that event. What was that like?
Oh, my God. Those days, everybody did it. So that was the way you did. You did an 8 o'clock dinner show and then a midnight show for people who had been to this was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So people went to the theater and would come after theater and, you know, have a late supper or whatever. And then at 2:15, when most people would have gone home, you had a sufficient number that the places would keep open, and they would just shorten the dancing girls' number a little bit and you know, cut a little bit here and there. But when Dean and Jerry were there, they were packed at 2:15.
Wow.
So we had a full show. It wasn't just 6, you know, indigent drunks who wanted it, or rich ones, mainly. But
how many people could be seated in the Copacabana?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Frankly, I don't know. The seating capacity, it's hard for me to remember that.
Yeah. What was Martin and Lewis's act like, and how did it feel to open for them? Was the audience receptive to your singing?
Well, if... they probably couldn't wait till Dean and Jerry got out, but I had enough of my own ability to keep them interested and like me, and they loved me, and then here they are, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis. But I did a full show, and it was very. We were there forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody got booked in probably for 2 weeks or a month at the most, and we were there forever. It was a very amazing rise for both of them. I knew them both before that, but they
yeah.
were not who they were, who they became, you know.
It was it's one thing that those of us who weren't there, fortunate enough to see them live, apparently we'll never know, because people say seeing them live was the only way to really see them.
Hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. First of all, Dean was very handsome at that time, and he was always a nice-looking guy, but, I mean, he was very handsome. And Jerry was a total clown, and they played off each other in the most unbelievably... it seemed everything was so casual, you know, but they knew what they were doing, and they were marvelous. They were really marvelous.
Well, there was a writer who wrote for Fred Allen, who many people have heard of. He's one of my heroes. And then I find out from you that he's kind of a stuffy guy. That was Herman Woke.
Yeah.
You dated him?
Yes, he was the families were friends, and then I knew him growing up, but he waited till I was 18 to ask me out.
Well, that was polite of him.
Yeah.
And you think you appear in one of his novels? You're not Marjorie Morningstar, are you?
could be, but the Mae Wynn character, that I think was in Winds of War, wasn't it?
Kay Mutiny.
Yeah, Mae Wynn was the name of the girl in that, and the actress who played her, whose name escapes me this minute, took the name of Mae Wynn as her professional name.
Yeah, she's just billed as Mae Wynn in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he based that, I think, on me. And he probably did Marjorie Morningstar. He says he did it about his sister, but I don't think so. I think that he was
thinking of you.
Putting it all together about the ambition and the drive and the theatrical aspirations. His sister did want to be an actress, but nothing much happened. She married a doctor and had a nice, normal life.
Your life was nice, but not particularly normal.
Well, it wasn't average. Let's put it that way. I try to keep it normal, but it was normal in a sense of organization and basic philosophy and my optimism and my caring about my family and the way I was. I don't know how I got to be that way, but that's who I was. And love of music.
Yes. Well, and you're a marvelous singer. Do you still sing?
I sang pretty well until just recently. In this last year, we had some horrendous fires in Los Angeles. And they whipped up a lot of trees and lots of new pollens and stuff. And I just coughed so much that when I had my cuckness come over and started to sing, I said, my high notes are just really awful, and I don't know what's going on, but I don't like the sound. And he said, oh, but you still can interpret, and oh, you make me cry when you sing this, and you know, you swing, and you can do this. I said, but I can't listen to it. I made him laugh, and I said, yeah, I make Diana Krall, who sings low, you know.
Yeah.
I said, I make her sound like a soprano. I'm singing down here. And he said, well, it's kind of sexy. I said, well, maybe for you, but it's doing nothing for me.
Who were the singers that influenced you?
Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
When I was 16 or so, I started to listen to, I listened to bands. In those days, we had big bands, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was with Chick Webb, I think. And
she had that kind of girlish voice. Your voice seems much more mature. You always sounded very...
Yes.
Yeah.
But she deepened later. Everybody does.
Right.
So you get a deeper chest tone. If you listen to the old Sarah Vaughan records...
Yes, oh yeah.
In her early days, very high.
Yes.
And then later it got very full and throaty and deep.
Yeah.
That's what the vocal cords are very funny. People don't realize they're these two little things in the throat. And as you grow older, they thicken so that the breath, you know, because singing is breathing. You have to breathe. And the air doesn't vibrate through them as fast. So that's why you get a deeper sound. Sinatra did it. I mean, everybody.
Was it harder to sing at 2 o'clock in the morning than at 7 o'clock in the evening?
Oh, I never thought anything was too hard. I was like a robot. Here's what you do, this is what you do, this is, you know.
Yeah.
Get your paycheck, give it to your mama.
Well, you mentioned Frank Sinatra. Now, he's one of the boys you said no to.
Yes, but he was a lifelong friend.
Yeah.
He was like a big brother. He really was.
Yeah.
I said no when I was all very early and on the phone.
Even if he'd asked you in person, you might have said yes?
I didn't say that. I'm glad it was on the phone because there's no scene. It was simple.
Well, speaking of people you said no to, you said no to a marriage proposal to this B-movie actor. Some people might remember. His name was Ronald Reagan.
Yep.
Although you went with him for a couple of years.
Yes.
And then you actively campaigned against him when he ran for governor of California.
Well, that's because he had switched parties. When I was seeing him, he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, which was, you know, actors, the pretty liberal people.
Yeah.
and so am I, and so was he.
So you didn't vote for your ex-beau when he
was... No, I did not. He became a Republican, and he went very far, as we all know, and he was a lovely man, and a very, very...
Was he? What was he like in the days when you knew him?
Delightful. He was charming. He was kind. He was a good-natured guy who, he would get rid of his frustrations by going up to a ranch and cutting wood and doing physical stuff, and you know. But he was not intellectually one of the five greatest minds in the country. But there was nothing wrong with it, and he was hip enough. I don't know if he was hip enough for me at that point in my life, and I think that maybe was the problem. I was in that period where I only really liked writers and comics and Ronnie. And so, you know, you go through stages of growing up. I don't know how it would have been 10 years later if I had grown up more or what. But I had fallen in love immediately anyway with a writer. And I knew I made the right choice, even though that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Monica Lewis, and she's just written her memoirs, Hollywood Through My Eyes. You worked with so many of the great ones, and I want to ask you about some of them because they're some of my heroes.
Sure.
I've been listening to a lot of your records and radio performances, and I heard you on the Bing Crosby radio show. What kind of a guy was Bing?
Well, he was just lovely to me. Again, he I did not know in the way that I knew some of these other people. I knew him to work with.
Yeah.
And he was just delightful and very protective. I had a wonderful experience with most of the big names because there was something that maybe made them feel protective about me. I don't know what it was. I don't know why it was, but it was. And that was helpful because certainly the guys who ran the nightclubs were not like that. You know, they were aggressive guys and you had to run like hell. Is that allowed to be said on your...
Yes, you can say anything you like.
Okay. Well, it's like I had roller skates, you know. I'm very, very... see ya. Show's over. Out. Gone.
Nobody got you on the casting couch, but many tried. Is that right?
Well, I think that was just par for the course for most people. You had to know how to duck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about singing duets with singers? Were some singers easier to sing with than others?
Yes. I can think of a bad example.
Good. Do tell.
Well, Eddie Fisher.
Yeah. Not a good duet singer?
No. Well, the problem, Eddie had a wonderful voice.
Yeah.
And he could, you know, sing, Oh, My Papa, and Make You Cry, and all of that. But he couldn't swing, and he had a rhythm problem. So we did a television show together. And we had to do this duet, and I figured out if I put my arm around his shoulder instead of his having his around mine. We were in a hansom cab in Central Park.
Yeah.
And I tapped him on the shoulder.
You were the human metronome.
Yes, I was the metronome and kept the beat going. Like, let's say it had to be you. It had to be you. Well, I kept pushing so that it would be, like, right. And we got through it fine, and everybody just loved it. And I'm telling you this story, and it's okay. And if Eddie's up there in heaven or wherever he is, he's smiling down saying, she's telling the truth.
That was big band singer Monica Lewis. She passed away on June 12, 2015, at the age of 93. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook and you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.